Welcome to the How the Why. With John Barrett Ingalls. Exploring and celebrating the creative process and the creative purpose of authors, editors, and artists that make up and inspire the Black Hill Press family. Black Hill Press is dedicated to the novella. We believe a great story is never defined by its length. Let's get creative.
Hello, and welcome to the How the Why, brought to you by Black Hill Press in 1888. My name is John Barrett Ingalls, and today we are connected with Chris Muñiz, the editor-in-chief of Goldline Press. Is that the correct title for you?
Yeah.
All right, good. Editor-in-chief. I like that. That's such a strong, strong title. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So, Goldline Press, you are affiliated with the USC, and right now you're currently in the doctoral program for creative writing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the press was actually started by a group of graduate students in 2010, and it's aligned with the literature and creative writing PhD program at USC here.
Now, how long have you been editor-in-chief? How long have you held your position?
Just this year, yeah. I mean, I've been involved since the beginning as a reader, as a sort of, you know, we have like a board where we meet and talk about the all the submissions that we get and that sort of thing. And we have a sister press called Ricochet Editions also, and sort of been involved in that. But this year was the first year that I've been editor-in-chief.
So Goldline, you focus on chapbooks. Small press, getting these beautiful little works of art, as you call them, out to the people. I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of what a chapbook is, but just to describe a little bit about what you know of the history of chapbook and what Goldline wants to do with it.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, most people are familiar with the poetry chapbook, right? It's a sort of a small, nicely bound collection of poetry, and less so with fiction. So one thing I'm always excited about with Goldline Press is that we're actually one of the few presses that publishes fiction in chapbook form. You know, there's novellas, which are longer, and obviously novels and short stories, but this is sort of something in between, which sort of fits with our overall aesthetic of sort of trying to find unique things that maybe don't fit in other presses or fit sort of in what we might consider a mainstream sort of idea of what poetry or fiction is. So we look for things that are kind of experimental, but they don't always have to be experimental, just things that sort of strike us as being unique in some way and that we find sort of interesting that will fit in the chapbook form so we can have these sort of like really nice sort of documents in a perfect bound book that's almost like an art object in and of itself, you know?
Right, it is an art. It is like a work of art. Where do you get the design ideas for the books?
We have a
team?
We have a small group of designers that we've been working with. Diana Arterian, who's one of the founders, and myself both graduated from CalArts with our MFAs. And so a lot of our designers have sort of come from like a pool of CalArts alumni. We've worked with just people who that we friends of friends kind of thing, or that will hit up and say, how would you be interested in sort of designing these? And as we've sort of progressed, like we sort of have this body of work where designers are now actually interested in designing for us because, you know, they just love the objects themselves and how it looks when it comes out.
So for Goldline in particular, everything that you release has been submitted for your contests, or do you release other titles as well?
So, yeah, Goldline is completely submission-based. So we have two guest judges each year, one in fiction, one in poetry. What will happen is we'll have a reading process where all the submissions will be read by readers from, you know, various interns all the way up to graduate students who just want to be readers, and maybe that's all they want to be and part of. And we vote on them, and then we have sort of a meeting where we say these are our finalists. We forward those finalists to the judges, and then the guest judges sort of selects which one they like the best, basically. And that's actually how Ricochet actually originally started, where we have these great manuscripts where we're like, oh, the judges didn't pick that. You know, we would love to still publish this. And so we sort of started this Ricochet, where that one's a little more driven by the editorial staff.
But it would still have to be, everything has to be submitted through the contest. Even to get into Ricochet, you would still have to
every now and then we will. Yeah, every now and then we'll put out a call. Like, we'll say, you know, we'll put out a call for Ricochet to say, I don't know, we'll have like an idea or something, or maybe we'll have a little extra funds. Usually those are people who have already submitted, though, and we'll say, you know, submit something. Well, I know we had like an anthology, so an aesthetics anthology that was going to be published, and so we'll put out a call for that. And, but for the most part, yeah, the submission is the sort of main sort of gateway into the system, I guess.
Do you have one contest a year?
We have one contest a year, yeah.
And you only take one poetry and one fiction or prose per contest?
Yeah. Yeah.
So every year you're for through Goldline, you're just releasing the two chapbooks.
Yeah, exactly. And then so Ricochet, we're sort of releasing more as sort of funds become available and that sort of thing.
Now, the Goldline, both Goldline and Ricochet, you're affiliated with USC. Is everything, it's all student-run, or are there faculty that are involved with it as well?
No, I mean, it's all student-run. The faculty that do get involved are usually our judges, right? So we've sort of been going, working our way through our all-star faculty, right? And we've sort of been... like this past year, we had Amy Bender as a fiction judge, and she's also a faculty member, you know, at USC. So, but for the most part, we do have some faculty oversight in terms of the money, right? And it's actually not faculty; it's actually staff. Our departmental coordinator sort of handles all the money side of it, and sort of coordinates with the college on that. For the rest of it, it's just us as students. Yeah, running. Hmm.
Do students stay on after they complete their studies?
You know, I don't think so. You know, we've only been around since 2010, and I'm thinking of they stay affiliated, but they haven't, and we'll often hit up some alumni who will say, I want to read, to be a part of the reading process. But so far, we haven't had anyone on the board who's wanted to stay on the board, you know, on the editorial board.
Now, let's talk a little bit about you and your studies and what brought you to USC to get your doctorate in creative writing. Where did you get your undergrad and your master's degree?
I actually got my undergrad in creative writing at USC, and then I went to MFA at CalArts in what at the time was called the Interdisciplinary Writing Program. Sort of affiliated with the critical studies department. And so it was like critical fiction hybrids, really sort of, you know, we were sort of trying to define really what we were trying to do at that time. And the program has since become pretty well established, and it had like these different subtracks. But at the time it was pretty sort of wide open. It was just called interdisciplinary writing. And then I had, you know, life experiences for a good, 5 to 10 years or so. And then I came back to USC for the literature and creative writing doctoral program because it's a nice mix of both the academic and the creative, I guess you could say. So the critical and creative are both important. When you get your doctorate from this program, you can go and teach literature just as much as you can go and teach creative writing. You know.
Is that your goal eventually, to become a professor?
Yeah, that would be my goal. Some people have gone through the program and then gone on to teach creative writing at various institutions, from universities down to sort of community colleges or whatever, as they sort of pursue their writing. And others have sort of gone to colleges and universities to teach literature, basically, you know. even Chicana literature and that sort of thing. So it sets you up for sort of there's a broad range of ways you can sort of use the program.
But are you still actively writing as well?
Yeah, I am. This is my fifth year. So I finished all the coursework, passed my quals, working on a novel. And then also, you know, the program's unique in that it's concurrently you work on a critical and a creative project. So I'm also laying the groundwork for my critical research as well, so which is literature-based. Yeah.
So is this next year going to be your final year?
Let's hope so. It should be, yeah. Yeah, it should be. It should be my last year.
It's interesting. We were talking a little bit before the interview. I have interviewed the two editors in chief of the Southern California Review, and both of them were in their master's program for the professional writing at
mm-hmm.
USD, and they were telling me that program got bought out by Vermont College of the Fine Arts. And so I was asking you a little bit about what the difference between the two programs are. Would you mind telling us the difference between a professional writing program and your creative writing, the academic program?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, at the time when the MPW program was active at USC, it was always odd to me that it was sort of a separate entity. You know, we didn't really cross paths in terms of classes and that kind of thing. And I think what its designation as a professional school meant that it was sort of considered separate from the PhD program, which is considered more academic and literary in nature. You know, we have a theoretical base, I guess you could say. Whereas my understanding of the classes for MPW was almost all craft-based. It was almost like what you might consider at another school to be an MFA, right? So this is, they call it the Masters of Professional Writing, and so you'd have actual playwrights come in and teach you playwriting, you know. There was screenwriting classes, and because I worked with a few people who were in that program, and they would have screenwriting, they would do playwriting, and so the idea sounded like it was meant to get you a broad sort of range of writing craft, right? In
to
all
go out and
fields.
Follow that and have that be the career path instead of more the academic side, or
exactly. Like, so for that, maybe that would be, I want to be write for television. That would be a much more sort of direct path to that. And then, you know, USC is really great about networking and bringing in industry people. So I'm sure they had screenwriters and television writers and these kind of things. So that could sort of guide you towards being a working writer in that sense. Right. Whereas I think the PhD program is meant to make you a professor, for one, you know, or more literary, whatever that term is, right, in that sense. And I think it sort of holds itself to a higher standard in terms of academic rigor, because it does sort of, we take the same classes that the people who are in the literature track do. A lot of our classes are the same classes as American Studies, people who are going to go on to become American Studies professors and that kind of thing.
So you said you're working on your on a novel. You're also working on your critical dissertation. What exactly is your theme or your focus for that?
On my critical disc, I'm focusing on a novel called Pocho, which was published in the 50s, late 50s, by Doubleday, and it's sort of before the Chicano movement actually happened, and before Chicano was sort of widely adopted as sort of a political sort of identity, I guess you could say. And so I originally started looking at that novel as a way of sort of discussing issues of masculinity and identity and all these kind of sort of broader themes. But in my research, I sort of came across this sort of unpublished, unnoticed version of the manuscript that's never been sort of seen, as far as I can tell, other than by the family. And so I'm going to sort of excavate that sort of thing and look at what the changes were between the version that Doubleday published and the changes that the original draft sort of had. And it still sort of crosses paths with all these ideas of identity and masculinity and race and ethnicity and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's good. Great, man. Wish you all the best of luck on that.
Yeah.
Now, going back to your position at Goldline and Ricochet. Could you tell us a little bit about what the editor-in-chief, I know you, so you're contest-based for Goldline.
Yeah.
You have your two judges, but where does your position fall within that?
So the editor-in-chief, you know, it's funny, we're going to, you know, the frame was talking about creative process and things like that. And the editor-in-chief is probably the least creative part of the whole thing. it's more like well, the manager, right?
Right.
And it's really sort of exposure to the publishing side of I guess, the industry or whatever, you know, this side of what we imagine, where books come from or something like that. So of course, you know, we sort of are tastemakers as a team, and we sort of, you know, we have judges and we have an aesthetic that we push. But really my job begins once the judges select a text. And, you know, I sort of oversee the fiction editor and the poetry editor. And together we work with the authors to sort of revise and sort of do final edits on the manuscript to get designers. You know, I'll get a designer for each one, and then I sort of put them in contact, and then we go through all the various stages of designing and laying out a text. I'm getting ISBN members and Library of Congress members and figuring out bleed margins and, you know, all these sort of weird things that I had never really thought about that I'm sort of having to learn as I go through it, you know.
Right.
And it's been a process, you know, it's been a learning process, but it's very interesting also to sort of see how a text, even a small, you know, independent text is put together basically, and all the sort of various sort of people and sort of points of contact that you have to make in order to make that happen.
Right. So, I mean, the book gets made, it's printed, the copies are out. What do you do with it? How do you publicize it? How do you get it into bookstores or people's hands?
So a lot of it is, you know, sort of grassroots, like most independent publishers. It's getting it into sort of local bookstores, getting it into contests, other contests in terms of like books that are published, you know, so you get recognized and say,
right,
this book was won whatever award. Obviously, you know, you submit to all the big Pulitzers and all these kind of things as well. And, you know, and our authors play a big role in that also. A lot of our authors are very proactive, and they'll do readings themselves, and, you know, they'll order books at cost, and we'll ship them books at cost, and they'll sort of sell them themselves wherever they go, you know, and they do their readings and that sort of thing. And then AWP is a big sort of place for us also, where we sort of have a high presence. We do a reading ourselves there. A lot of our books sort of are sold there as well, kind of thing. But most of our orders actually come through our online sort of interface. You know, it's surprising how much comes through there.
Do you publish in e-readers as well, or only in the chatbook format?
Only in chatbook. And there has been a discussion about going to e-readers, and so far we're not moving in that direction because we like the sort of physical nature of the chatbook and the art and the sort of printing that we sort of, you know, it's aesthetically important to us to sort of look and feel good in a weird way, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Where do your authors come from and your poets? Are they from all over, or are they students at USC as well, or?
No, we've had most of our authors, I'm trying to think internationally. I don't think we've had too many international. We have had some in the past, but none that have sort of won the contest. But most of them are sort of early stage writers. Some are still in programs of their own, whether they're doctoral or FFA programs, or some are early stage writers who are just writing for a living, I assume. I don't know, you know. But almost always that's not as important as the text itself in a way, you know. So we've had a sort of wide range of people, age-wise also, you know, who sort of submitted, some older writers who are sort of getting back into it, and some younger writers who are just trying their hand out, you know, at trying to enter contests and saying, I don't know where this goes, maybe this is a good fit for you, kind of thing.
With your Ricochet editions, are you limited to how many of those you'll print a year?
That is limited only in the sense of our budget. So, and again, that depends on a number of factors, you know, the fluctuations in the budget that we have from the university,
but also fluctuations in how large a text is or how much color or how much, you know, the size of it actually matters. You know, the smaller, we could print a bunch of smaller ones. If we print one giant anthology, maybe that eats up some of the budget.
Right.
But a lot of the sales money that we get also goes back into that. So it depends on if we've had a good year, then that goes back into sort of the pot to sort of publish things as well.
Chris, I'm going to have you do something if you don't mind. We at Black Hill Press in 1888 started at the beginning of this year a program called Routinology, and that's where we do a kind of a study on the routine of creative people. And now you're wearing three hats, really. You're wearing your creative hat, your academic hat, and this editor-in-chief hat. And I'd love to hear what some of your routines are when you wear all of those different hats. I mean, if it's the same, if you need the same things when you're sitting and working on your novel as you do when you're working on your critical dissertation, or when you're sitting and working as the editor-in-chief, you know, what do you need in your life? Music, caffeine, like a full stomach. Would you mind going into some of your routine?
Sure. Sure. All the things that, you know, we all need, we probably don't get enough of, right? Like sleep and that sort of thing. But I do always feel like when I come to the creative stuff, I want to have sort of a full battery, almost to say. So it's always like finding a quiet space, making sure, you know, I'm fed, that sort of thing are always most important. But for me, the routine is basically waking up, checking emails, you know, working on the creative stuff first, because I sort of had to force myself to do that, because the tendency is to sort of get caught up in the minutiae of all this sort of busy work of being an editor. Those are easy things, right? The deadlines that you can meet for that are very tangible, and the feedback is immediate. But I sort of have to sort of force myself to put that off towards the end of the day. Or sometimes even I'll put it off and say, like, you know, I'm not going to go back to until Wednesday if there's no deadlines or anything like that.
Hmm.
And it's Monday, you know, I'll wait a few days just to focus. I try to focus on one thing at a time, almost like without any sort of distractions whatsoever. Otherwise, I sort of get scattered. And so that's what sort of works best for me, is if I just sort of devote at least an hour or two to creative work. The reading and that sort of thing with critical work can sort of come at any time. I find I do better when I'm actually on campus for that kind of stuff, because libraries seem more conducive to sort of sitting there and reading. When I'm at home, I sort of get distracted by email and that sort of thing a little easier.
Sure.
if the computer's there.
Yeah.
But the editor-in-chief stuff can happen anywhere. You know, we have our meetings. I'll check emails throughout the day, and a lot of it is, you know, through email. So it's sort of one of those sort of modern day weird managerial things that you can sort of manage in a virtual space almost, you know. But the trick is to not sort of let that overwhelm everything else.
Yeah. How do you prioritize as far, you know, as what your time is going to be spent on?
Yeah. I think for me, the priority is just reminding myself that the critical work is important. And so sort of, even though there's not an immediate sort of payoff on that, just sort of force myself to sort of sit down, do that fresh first thing in the morning. It's almost like exercise, right? You say, like, if you go and work out, then you're like, okay, I've accomplished that. Now I can go on with the rest of my day. And then a lot of those other tasks, not that they're simpler tasks, but the amount of energy or the kind of energy that goes into them can be sort of, I think, is a lot easier for me to manage later throughout the day. Than if I was putting off creative writing till the afternoon. I know, look, you know, let's be tired. I want a nap or something.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you an early riser?
I'm not that early. I'm actually, you know, I have a son who's an 8-year-old son. So during the school year, I got to get up at 6:30 to take him to school. And then by the time all that's done, it's about 8-ish when I get back home. But, you know, normally I would probably actually rather stay up later and then get up a little later. But that sort of forces my day to sort of start a little earlier. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I know that. I know that routine too.
Yeah.
I have a 6-year-old daughter.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and wish you all the best with your studies and with your paper and your it's not even a paper. I mean, you can't even call it a paper.
It's a giant paper. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very, very long paper, and your book as well. And
thank you.
I recommend everybody to go to check out Goldline Press. I mean, the address is dornsife.usc.edu/goldlinepress. Dornsife. Dornsife.
And I think if you just Google it, you know, it'll just shoot you right there, because I always forget the actual web interface also.
Yeah, Google Goldline Press and check out their books. I mean, the artwork itself is worth the look. Thank you again, buddy. You know, good luck with everything.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This has been The How, The Why by Black Hill Press in 1888. I'm John Barrett Ingalls. The show is produced by Kevin Stanek and yours truly, with production assistance by Sarah Becker. The music is Maya Lua by Bossa Zuzu. I wanted to thank everybody for your creativity and your inspiration, and to remind you all to keep making art. Thank you.